Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, Living with Myeloproliferative Neoplasms, and this is part six of this six-part series, and today's program is focusing on recognizing the different stages of your MPN, understanding why your doctor may need to adjust your treatment over time. This is a very important workshop in this entire series. Now, this entire series has been a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, as well as the MPN Education Foundation and the MPN Research Foundation. And it is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 337 participants, and you come from all over the United States. So you come from all different parts of the United States. And we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, Tunisia, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So really from all over the world. And it's a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us to learn more about this topic. Today's program was made possible by Insight Corporation. I really want to thank them for their support, not only of this workshop today, but of this entire six-part series. Now, I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that you received from Cancer Care. You either got them electronically, or a few of you may have gotten it also in the mail as well. Then in those materials is information about our speakers and the topics we'll be addressing. There also is information about all of our collaborating organizations as a resource to you. They have 800 numbers, they have websites, and they have free information that could be of help to you. In addition, there is an evaluation form, and I would ask you all to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. You are our best consultants or best suggesters of the programs that we should be offering. You have the best insight as to what we should be offering to you. And so I would very much encourage you to fill out the evaluation form and tell us what you'd like us to offer going forward. Now, indeed, this was a very expansive program, a six-part series, and many of the topics that we chose for this series were topics that you had written about in other evaluations that you'd completed on this topic. So please do, on MPNs that you had asked us to do some other topics as well. So we take very seriously what you suggest, and we try very hard to implement your suggestions. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our teleconference today, and I'd like to begin by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Jason Robert Gottlieb. Dr. Gottlieb is Associate Professor of Medicine, Hematology, Director, Stanford MPN Center, Stanford University School of Medicine, Stanford Cancer Institute. And Dr. Gottlieb is going to address an overview of staging and diagnosing of myeloproliferative neoplasms, communicating with the healthcare team about staging and progression of MPN, and talking with your doctor about quality of life, symptoms, side effects, prognosis, and life expectancy concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Gottlieb.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and I'd like to thank Cancer Care and Dr. Messner for the opportunity to speak to patients and caregivers in this live forum. And my task today is indeed to review the diagnosis and staging of myeloproliferative neoplasms, which I will abbreviate as MPNs. So let me first start with diagnosis. And as physicians, we want to know certain aspects of the patient's history. So we take a history from patients. We want to know how long have you, as a patient, felt new adverse symptoms or felt unwell. We're always interested in symptoms related to thick blood, you know, which can be found in patients with an elevated platelet count or red blood cell count. So we'll ask questions about headache or confusion or stroke-like symptoms. Have there been any cardiac or heart symptoms, such as chest pain? Has there been any issues with itching, particularly after hot baths or showers, which is a symptom that we can see in the MPN polycythemia vera in particular? We'd like to know how long have there been blood counts that have been abnormal. This could give a sense of prior duration of disease. Is there any history of red blood cell or platelet transfusions? Or conversely, how long has a patient, for example, with polycythemia vera required phlebotomy, that is, to take off excess red blood cells? We often want to see an updated list of medications from the patient. That can be very useful, as well as their prior history of medical problems. For example, if a patient has pre-existing heart disease or lung disease, this may impact what type of treatment decisions we may make or suggest for the patient. We, of course, will examine the patient. We want to see on physical examination whether the patient has a large spleen or liver. These are findings that we can see in patients with PV and essential thrombocythemia, or ET, and in particular, myelofibrosis. We will often look for signs of gout. And gout is painful swelling of one or more joints, and this is related to a lot of uric acid in the blood, which is often a common finding in MPNs. We will look at, of course, the laboratory data. We want to look at the CBC, or complete blood count. We're looking to see if the white blood cell count is elevated or low. We want to see the level of maturity of the white blood cells, because increasing immaturity of the white blood cells can indicate that the disease, whether it be PV, ET, or myelofibrosis, is moving toward acute leukemia. We want to look at the chemistries. We want to look at the liver function tests. And we want to make determinations about whether one of the MPNs is affecting the chemistries or liver function. We want to look at the mutation status of the patient. This is a blood draw, and we often talk about the JAK2 mutation. And the JAK2 mutation is common in all these MPNs, but it's not used alone to specify whether the patient has PV, ET, or myelofibrosis. And then this era of DNA sequencing, where an increasing number of centers are able to analyze numerous genes at one time, we can use these gene analysis tests and determine if they're mutated. And if they're mutated, this can actually provide additional information about prognosis for some patients, particularly those with myelofibrosis. And oftentimes, we'll perform a bone marrow biopsy to establish the type of MPN that a patient has. We'll look at the cellularity of the bone marrow. We'll look at whether there are increased numbers of immature cells or blasts within the bone marrow to suggest higher-risk disease. And we'll look at, of course, the amount of scar tissue to see whether the patient may have myelofibrosis and what stage of myelofibrosis. And then finally, we'll look at the chromosome abnormalities to see whether they're present. And there are certain good risk, intermediate risk, and poor risk chromosome abnormalities that may also help gauge prognosis. And as a final bullet point to this issue of diagnosing myeloproliferative neoplasms, I'll make this statement. The diagnosis of an MPN is not just based on mutation status of JAK2. It takes into consideration the patient's signs of disease, their physical examination, the laboratory data, bone marrow results, and the exclusion of other causes of an elevated white blood cell count, red blood cell count, or platelet count to establish, again, whether an MPN is present and whether it's PV, ET, or myelofibrosis. Now, regarding staging, we physicians who study MPNs and treat patients with MPNs use certain staging systems to evaluate what type of level of disease is present, whether they have low risk or higher risk disease, and this can also guide us in terms of treatment options. So, for example, in the case of PV and ET, the two factors that we often employ is age and whether the patient has a history of a blood clot or thrombosis. And for patients that have lower risk disease, we, for example, for patients with PV, may just use aspirin and phlebotomy. For patients with PV that have high risk disease, that is, they're above age 60 or have had a history of a blood clot, we may use an additional drug like hydroxyurea to get the blood counts down in addition to aspirin and phlebotomy. In the case of myelofibrosis, we use staging systems that employ various clinical and laboratory features. And these systems, which go by the name IPSS, or International Prognostic Scoring System, or DIPSS Plus, Dynamic International Prognostic Scoring System, again, they can be used at the time of diagnosis or any time during the disease. And there are multiple factors that we look at, for example, age greater than 65, whether the red blood cell count or hemoglobin is less than 10, whether there are constitutional symptoms present, such as fevers, night sweats, or weight loss, the percentage of blasts in the blood, the white blood cell count, the platelet count, the need for red blood cell transfusions, and the chromosome profile. And we can determine, generally speaking, what the prognosis is regarding average overall survival and the risk of progressing to acute leukemia. And more recently, prognostic scoring systems have been used in PVNET to also provide information about long-term survival. So what I'd like to do now is move on to the topic of communicating with your healthcare team about staging and progression of MPN. And there are certain items that a hematologist or oncologist can use to evaluate whether the disease is progressing or what stage it is. And the first is whether the blood counts are changing. Is there a trend over time that shows that there's worsening anemia, a worsening platelet count, that is a decreasing platelet count, or an increasing platelet count? And whether the white blood cell count is changing substantially, is it substantially getting worse, that is lower, or is it getting very high? And also the level of maturity of the white blood cells. If the white blood cells are getting more immature, that can indicate progression to high-risk disease or acute leukemia. Another question that we'll ask is, are the patient's symptoms getting worse? Is there more weight loss? Is the spleen increasing and signs becoming more uncomfortable? Is the patient developing more fatigue or night sweats or fevers? Are there more bone pain or muscle aches? Are there recurrent episodes of gout? These are clues that can indicate that the disease is evolving or changing over time or progressing within myelofibrosis or toward acute leukemia. Another question we'll ask is the patient developing a new requirement for or increased frequency of red blood cell transfusions? Or is there a new requirement for platelet transfusions? Or again, conversely, is a patient with PV requiring more and more phlebotomy to take the excess red blood cells off? This may require the physician to make some changes in approach to therapy. Another question we'll ask is, if the patient is on a stable dose of a drug like hydroxyurea, which is used to reduce the blood counts, is the need for phlebotomies decreasing or are the counts stable on a stable dose of hydroxyurea? If the counts are suddenly getting worse on a stable dose of hydroxyurea, that can indicate that the marrow function is getting worse. They may prompt us to do more evaluation, including a bone marrow biopsy. Another question is the patient developing new clots or bleeding? This may also require us to rethink the therapy that the patient is on. So many of these questions may ultimately require us to think about restaging the disease and whether a new bone marrow biopsy is required to see whether the disease is progressing or if it's in a new stage, and to consider alternative therapies, including transplant. So finally, I'd like to talk about discussing with your doctor quality of life, symptoms, side effects, prognosis, and life expectancy concerns. The first thing I'll say is that, at least in the context of the disease myelofibrosis and now also for PVNET, there is a validated symptom assessment form that is universally used around the world to assess the presence of and the severity of symptoms. And I think that this is very useful for investigators or physicians to query patients to see what the level of their symptoms are related to their disease. I think it's very useful for patients to have a diary of symptoms at home about the side effects or tolerability of new medications and the frequency of transfusions that they're undergoing at their local center. I think that talking about prognosis related to life expectancy and the chances of transforming to acute leukemia is something that is certainly a centerpiece of discussions with patients, whether they have low-risk disease or particularly high-risk disease. And I mentioned there are now prognostic scoring systems that we can use to provide a general sense of the patient about their prognosis. And any individual case should, of course, be discussed with their own doctor. The patients should ask their doctors, what does progression look like? What should patients be looking for? What should be the frequency of blood draws or doctor visits? The frequency of blood draws or doctor visits may, in fact, change if there is a concern that their disease is progressing over time. If progression is observed, or even if no progression is observed, there certainly should be a discussion about a multidisciplinary approach to patient care. This can involve dietitians, this can involve patient support groups, spiritual supportive care, and this is something that a patient and or their caregiver should ask at an early point of the evaluation of an MPN. The patient or caregiver should always ask about whether there's any available clinical trials and whether it's available to them and whether it's appropriate. And then the caregivers or family members that are visiting with the patient is an essential part of the visit. They can provide note-taking. They can provide emotional support. They can provide another ear to act as a scribe to play back the doctor's recommendations. I think this is very important. And finally, The use of exercise, meditation, holistic alternative health options should also be discussed, and referrals should be undertaken by the doctor. So we, of course, have standard or conventional therapies that are used for MPNs, but it's also very valuable to see whether there are options beside conventional care that may provide global quality of life improvement for the patient with an MPN. So I'll stop there, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to speak to you, and I'll be available, of course, to answer questions at the end of the conference.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gottlieb. That was really outstanding and very informative for everyone on the call, so thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Christina Gowan, Dr. Christina Gowan. And Dr. Gowan is with the Mayo Clinic, Arizona, hematology and medical oncology fellow, MPN researcher. And Dr. Gowan is going to address working with your healthcare team to manage the different stages of MPN and needed changes in your treatment plan protocol, understanding your treatment changes and who to contact with your questions, and tips for getting the most from each medical appointment. Questions to ask your doctor. That's really an important question. So, Dr. Gowan, I'm going to turn the program over to you.
Well, thank you, Carolyn, for that very kind introduction, and thank you, Dr. Gottlieb, for that very thorough discussion, which I really hope to contribute to in the next few minutes. MPN is a diagnosis that represents a spectrum of disease and is often quite dynamic. The disease can change or progress, which may result in an entirely new set of symptoms. Likewise, therapy for MPN is dynamic, often changing to meet the needs of the patient. Learning to navigate the healthcare system and effectively communicate with your healthcare team is essential for all patients, but particularly with those afflicted with myeloproliferative neoplasms. So perhaps it would be most helpful to begin by defining who makes up the healthcare team. In addition to your primary health care provider, many individuals contribute to the delivery of care, which include, but certainly is not limited to, nurses, social workers, pharmacists, mental health professionals, dietitians, interpreters, family and friends, and finally, yourself. I would like to share some recommendations to help maximize your communication with each team member. When communicating with your primary care providers, such as your doctor, nurse practitioner, or physician assistant, please don't be afraid to ask questions. I encourage you to be as descriptive in your symptom assessment as you can. Be sure to discuss tolerance of medications and side effects. Be honest with any difficulty taking medications as prescribed, and discuss your difficulties with your provider. Communicate issues such as uncontrolled pain and nausea immediately. There are ways to treat these symptoms effectively, and there is no need to be uncomfortable until your next scheduled visit. Be sure to call for fever, as this can be a medical emergency and at times may need immediate treatment. Nurses, I encourage you to tell them your story. They are quite compassionate and tend to have more time than your primary care provider. They often can communicate missed issues with your physician. They are great educators and can be a great resource to further understand your illness. Social workers, be aware they are available to you to assist with logistics of therapy and provide valuable information of support groups and other community resources. They additionally can offer emotional support to you and your loved ones. Pharmacists, be sure to discuss all medications with your pharmacist to ensure you are taking your medications at the proper times, with or without food, and to ensure you have no drug interactions. Dietitians, nutrition may become an issue, particularly in those afflicted with myelofibrosis, who may have enlarged spleens and significant weight loss. Be sure to inquire about a nutrition consult to maximize your nutritional status. Mental health professionals. Like all chronic illnesses, MPNs can take their toll on you mentally. Fatigue can be debilitating and can lead to significant depression. Anxiety related to treatment may exist. Try to establish a mental health professional relationship early on if symptoms of depression or anxiety develop. Interpreter. For those who have hearing loss or speak another language, interpreter services are essential to be sure you're getting everything out of your healthcare experience and not missing vital information. Family and friends. Entrust family and friends with your experience as a patient. Support from loved ones is enormously therapeutic, and often they can provide help in unexpected ways. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, you. You are your most important member of your healthcare team. Learn to be your own best advocate. Educate yourself on the disease, treatment options, and best supportive care techniques. Remember that although you do not have control of your disease, you do have control of your lifestyle, a major determinant of your overall health. As you can see, multiple resources exist within your healthcare team, and I hope you won't hesitate to utilize them to get the maximum benefit from therapy in the future. As I mentioned before, MPNs can change dramatically in both symptom complex as well as treatment recommendations. It can be confusing and overwhelming to understand why treatment changes are necessary. In general, recognize the disease itself often changes. For example, essential thrombocytosis and polycythemia vera can transform to myelofibrosis. When this happens, new treatment protocols are often necessary. Recognize that even within the same disease entity, symptoms and blood counts may vary drastically, which will require new treatment regimens. When a new treatment is recommended, be sure to take the time with your healthcare provider to understand why and how the new treatment differs. Ask your doctor who you can contact if questions remain after your visit. Often nursing or other supportive staff are available. And finally, I'd like to share some general tips for getting the most from each office visit with your primary care provider. It is essential to come to each visit prepared. Prior to each visit, consider writing down some notes. Some ideas include questions you may have, how you've been feeling generally, changes you may have noticed in your body, any worries or concerns you have, and issues related to treatment and side effects. Be sure to bring a friend or family member. Much information is discussed at each office visit, and often it's difficult to remember all the details reviewed. Two sets of ears are always better than one. Be sure to take notes. These may be helpful to recall all the details of the visit later. Ask your provider the best way to leave urgent messages and how quickly to expect a response. Ask about after-hour protocols and whom you should contact in the event of an emergency. Inquire as to how test results are relayed, personally versus telephone versus online systems. Each medical system is different, and it will serve you well to learn to navigate yours. Members of your healthcare team can get very busy. It might seem like there's no time to talk about your questions and concerns. If your healthcare provider has a time limit for each patient, try making arrangements for a longer meeting. Ask for the time you need to discuss your questions. MPNs can be a complex diagnosis to understand given the dynamic nature of the disease and the treatment. Understanding how to engage the healthcare team leads to maximum benefit of therapy. Don't be afraid to ask questions and try to understand each step of the process. And finally, utilizing tips for maximizing each office visit may lead to better communication and enhanced satisfaction from your healthcare delivery. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Gahan. That was really outstanding and really very helpful to people to have very specific tips in terms of the various ways to handle different appointments and questions to ask, things to be aware of, and also the different members of the healthcare team that you identified. That was really helpful as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Sari Kelly. Ms. Kelly is an oncology social worker, and she's coordinator of older adult services at Cancer Care. And she's going to address stress management, relaxation tips for living each day, and review Cancer Care's pre-professional psychosocial services provided by trained oncology social workers and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. And I'd like to thank everyone on the call. I think we've gotten so much good information today. So as Dr. Messner said, I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and I work with many people who are diagnosed with MPN and their loved ones. You know, today we've been talking about managing your care and quality of life, and I'd like to begin by speaking about the importance of managing your stress as part of the care. Having a diagnosis of MPN can be stressful. You know, today we've been talking about the unique aspects of MPN, changes in treatment, and also just the fact that the illness tends to be more chronic. So, you know, there are going to be a lot of ups and downs with this. And while it may not be possible to eliminate all the sources of stress, there are some things you can do to help yourself. And so I'd like to start with some practical tips to reduce stress. First and foremost, check in with yourself. I think it's such an important thing to do, actually for everyone, and I don't think that we necessarily do it enough. You know, check in. Ask yourself, how am I feeling? You know, am I stressed? Am I feeling it physically? Am I feeling it emotionally? Our bodies respond to physical and emotional stress by relieving stress hormones, and it's a natural occurrence. It's supposed to happen. You know, it can help you in a moment of stress sort of give you an extra boost to kind of get through it. That said, it increases your blood pressure. Your heart rate can speed up. It can raise your blood sugar levels. And if this is happening on an ongoing basis due to, you know, your diagnosis of MPN and everything that comes with that, it can really take a toll. So you want to find ways of managing it. Checking in with yourself really is such an important part of this. Listen to your body. It's going to let you know sort of what's going on. Another part of this is being aware of your limits. You know, when you're asking yourself, how am I feeling? Are you feeling tired physically, emotionally? Do you need to take a step back? Do you need to take a break? Also, allow yourself to say no, and this one can be tough. You know, maybe friends, family are asking you to do something, or maybe it's a colleague that's asking you to do a task that maybe you don't have time or energy to complete because of fatigue coming from the cancer and its treatment. So you want to be able to tell people no when you need to. You really want to be thinking about your own care in this. Another part of it, and this is a very practical one, is getting organized. And I know, you know, some of us are better at it than others. It's not always the easiest, but using a calendar, creating a list of tasks, breaking things down into more manageable chunks, so breaking those tasks down, and concentrating your efforts on things that you can control. And this is also not the easiest, but, you know, you may be, you know, in conflict with a doctor's schedule, maybe traffic issues, these things out of your control, even with the best planning. So, you know, it's really focusing on those things that you can control, and sometimes knowing that the aspect of a problem you can control is how you're reacting to it. So another big piece of this is asking for help, and I'm going to talk more about this in depth in a minute, but asking family, friends, health professionals, I know we've been talking a lot about that today, asking for help is a sign of strength, whether it's support for a specific task, you know, running errands, helping with meals, or for psychosocial support through counseling groups, all of this can really help alleviate some of the stress. And then also in terms of practical help, getting help with financial problems. And, you know, this is a big one, and it doesn't get talked about as often, but it's such an important part of this. So if you're struggling with the financial aspect of this, ask an oncology social worker, a financial advisor, you know, talk to the treatment center, find ways that you can also get support and financial help. And then just very quickly, some other stress management strategies, and I imagine your doctors are talking to you about this, but exercise, healthy diet, getting adequate sleep, good rest, social activities, you know, being with friends, being with people that you care about, you know, doing things like that, laughing, all of these things can help, and also just engaging in activities you enjoy. Those are all also stress management techniques that can help with us. And then I'm going to take a minute to talk about relaxation techniques. And, you know, it's something that gets thrown out there, and it may sound like it's such an easy thing to tackle. It's actually a little bit harder sometimes than it seems. Relaxation techniques are, I find, a great way to help with the stress management. You know, earlier I mentioned what happens to our bodies when we're dealing with stress. Relaxation techniques, really, it's a process of decreasing some of those effects of stress on your mind and body. And I think that relaxation techniques can help you cope with stress related to your MPN, but also just with everyday stress. You know, I talked about traffic earlier, those sort of frustrations that come up in the day-to-day. Relaxation techniques can help with it. And the key is learning to relax. And I stress the word learning. Relaxation is a skill like anything else, and it may take some time to develop. So briefly, just some benefits of using relaxation techniques. It can slow your heart rate, lower your blood pressure, reduce the activity of the stress hormones that get released when you're under stress. It's going to increase blood flow to major muscles and organs, reducing your muscle tension, can lower fatigue, it can improve your concentration, it can improve your mood, which is always a good thing. And I also find it can help, it just gives you a little bit of confidence that, you know, you can manage some of the issues that are coming up and, you know, have control over some of these things. So whether you have a handle on your stress or you find you're struggling with it, I think anyone can benefit from learning relaxation techniques. The other great thing about it is they're often free or, you know, at a low cost. They pose little health risk, and you can do them just about anywhere. To get the most benefit, I would say you want to use some of the relaxation techniques along with some of the other coping techniques that we discussed earlier. So I'm going to go over just a few of the sort of basic relaxation techniques. And I'm going to start actually with breathing. While it sounds simple, breathing is just such an important part of life. You know, sometimes you'll hear people talk about the breath of life. It is so important. And so relaxing your breathing or doing deep breathing can really help. And one of the things you can do just to sort of check in and see, okay, where am I with this? You can put your hands on your stomach. Or, you know, if it helps, you can even put your fingers sort of on your belly button. And just check in, because what's going to happen as you're doing that, you'll see that your stomach will rise and fall with your breathing. And it gives you an idea of, am I breathing too quickly? Is my breathing even? You want your breathing to be even and at a slower rate. And one of the things you can do is count sort of in and out. An easy number is 4, but you want to make sure it feels comfortable for you to really even out your breathing and slow things down. And you can feel as you're doing it, it just does wonders. You may feel your muscles relax. You may feel your heart rate go down. This is something you can use anywhere, and I just find it's such a helpful thing to do. So that is a big one. That one really is a good one also to start with, because it's relatively easy. So, you know, starting with the breathing. And then a few others, mental imagery or visualization. It's a technique you can use where you can imagine being in a relaxing place and really putting yourself there. And that can also soothe the stress, bring some of these things down, and just get you to a more relaxed place. Another one is progressive muscle relaxation. That's a technique where really you're tightening and then relaxing your muscles, starting at the toes or the head, you know, whatever you feel most comfortable with. And then you're progressively relaxing muscles and tightening them. So maybe you're making a fist and then releasing it. And then also meditation. And I know earlier in the NPN series, we talked about meditation and more in depth. And meditation is sometimes daunting for people. I think they hear it and they think, oh, well, I don't really know what that is, or, you know, how to even go about finding out about it. All it is quieting the mind. And as our minds become quiet, our muscles relax, heart rate and breathing slow down. There are a lot of different types of meditation out there. And one of the things I'll say about all of these techniques is there's a lot of information out there on how to do these techniques. You know, I definitely recommend, if you haven't talked to someone about this, bringing it up at your hospital treatment center. Often they have classes. You know, at Cancer Care, we actually do, if you're in the New York area, have a meditation class and mindfulness classes and workshops. And then we also have information on our website, which is www.cancercare.org. So really checking in. There's so much out there now, also just with YouTube, iTunes, Amazon. You know, there's a lot of sort of guided visualizations, relaxation. There are a lot of resources out there for this. So check into it if you haven't. And I just, you know, I think it can really help manage some of these stress. You know, the other piece of this is, as you're learning the relaxation techniques, you're going to become more aware of your body and the physical sensation of stress. And once you know what that feels like, you can really make a conscious effort to practice relaxation when that stress comes up. You'll just be more aware of it. And then also just stressing that they are skills, and as with any skill, your ability to relax improves with practice. So just practicing it, being patient with yourself, and that, you know, don't let it become another stressor. I've definitely heard that from people I've worked with, that they started feeling stressed out by practicing the relaxation. Be patient with yourself. It takes some time. And also know that it's never one size fits all. You know, one relaxation technique that may work for someone else may not work for you. So if it's not, you know, try another. It really is, there's so much out there, so you're going to find one, I imagine, that will work for you. So just know it's a tool you can use, anyone can use it, and it's so helpful. And I want to go back a little bit. I mentioned support as a means of sort of reducing stress, and so I want to talk about that a little bit more in depth. We've been talking today about how MPN can affect the whole person, right? So your mind, your body. It also affects your entire support network. Asking for help, joining a support group, contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. And I really want to stress with you that you don't have to do this alone. And I'm going to talk about how Cancer Care can be with you as a support and to really walk with you on this path. So Cancer Care is a non-profit organization. We're a national organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling. We do that face-to-face in the New York area and also over the phone nationally. Support groups, we do those face-to-face in New York and over the telephone nationally. We also do them online nationally and internationally. We have education programs like the one we're on today. We provide practical help, how to navigate the healthcare system, and also just some limited financial assistance as well as chemotherapy copay assistance. All of our services, and Dr. Messner mentioned this earlier, they're provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers, and they are completely free of charge. And oncology social workers really are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends or the support network. We're also trained to help patients and supports tackle the problems that accompany the disease. You know, today we were talking about so many different aspects of it, communication with doctor, what happens with treatment changes. We're also here to help you with, you know, the financial demands, social adjustment, the psychological impact, and just overall care. And I find that finding ways of adjusting to and coping to the diagnosis is such an important part of the healing process and really is part of the treatment and part of your care. So in joining a support group, you're really connecting with others who are going through a similar situation or having similar problems. Individual counseling gives you a space that's just yours to voice any concerns that are coming up for you. And the connections help lessen the isolation that can come with this experience. So feeling well emotionally helps you better deal with the diagnosis and treatment. And as I said earlier, I really feel like this is just part of the treatment. At this time, I did want to let you know, we do have an online support group for anyone diagnosed with blood cancers. We also do face-to-face groups in the New York area and phone groups. There are general patient groups and also caregiver groups. So I want you guys to know that those are there for you. If you're interested in any of these services, get in touch with us. You know, I mentioned our website earlier. It's www.cancercare.org. We have such a comprehensive website. There's a lot of information on support, other aspects of the diagnosis and treatment. And also it lists all of our services, and you can register for the online groups there. And then you can also call us at our Hope Line, and that's 1-800-813-HOPE or 1-800-813-4673. Our oncology social workers, we're all on the line. So please call us with, you know, questions you have, concerns you have, either about today's talk or other issues that are coming up. And also you can call us to register for any of our services. So really, we're here. You know, I think we've learned so much from today's program. There's a lot of information for us to get our arms around. We're here to help you do that. So, you know, connect with us on our website, give us a call on our Hope Line, and really remember you're not alone in this. You know, we're here to help you. Thanks so much for your attention and the opportunity to talk today.
Oh, thank you so much, Sarah. That was really, really wonderful. And I think people have a lot of wonderful tips to use in coping with stress and using relaxation techniques. And really, I think you shed some really wonderful light on that. I think there'll be questions for you on that during the Q&A as well. So, well, now we have time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board. And if you could explain to the audience how to queue up for questions. I see already we have a lot of online questions. So let's see what we have. If you just let everyone know how to ask questions both on the telephone and online. Thanks.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone to ask a question.
And we have a question from one of our online participants, from Diane. In our Facebook support group, we often see members who have oncologists, hematologists who are not familiar with MPNs. For those whose insurance will not cover an appointment at larger comprehensive facilities with MPN specialists, how would you suggest we find a doctor with MPN experience? Most recently, a member who lives near Phoenix who isn't able to go to the comprehensive center there was requesting help. Dr. Gottlieb, could you address this in a general way in terms of just thoughts that about how people could approach this?
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Bester. Diane, I think that's a very good question. I think one needs to take a step back and realize that MPNs are not particularly common disorders. Certainly, if you look at their incidence, the incidence or new diagnoses of these are 1 to 2 or maybe 2 or 3 in 100,000, and that's substantially below the more common cancers that one hears about, such as breast cancer, lung cancer, colon cancer. And so a community hematologist slash oncologist may not either feel comfortable or may not have seen a lot of patients in the previous experience with PV, ET, or myelofibrosis. So if the patient feels like they want to seek a second opinion, I would have the patient work with either their primary physician or internist or family doctor and or their first visit with that hematologist oncologist and see whether they can get a referral to a academic medical center that's in the area, and whether it be a comprehensive cancer center or another large group that may have seen more patients with these diseases. And sometimes it may need some advocacy on behalf of the local primary care doctor or the initial hematologist or oncologist that is seen to advocate on their behalf with the insurance to get authorization for that second opinion with a specialist who sees a lot of patients with MPNs. So it's really, again, working with a local doctor, whether it be primary care or hematologist, and advocating and fighting on your behalf to get insurance to carry through without authorization for at least an initial consultation. And I find that that often works.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. And we have another question from one of our other online participants. Interesting question about Jakafi. Since Jakafi often makes us more prone to infections, if you are having surgery to clear out the infection, do you need to temporarily stop the Jakafi? Dr. Gottlieb, can you address that?
And who is the name of the individual who asked this question?
It was actually from John.
John, thank you, John, for that question. So I would say this, that, you know, Jakafee is the brand name for the drug ruxolitinib, and ruxolitinib is a JAK inhibitor, and it's currently approved in the United States for intermediate or high-risk myelofibrosis. And it is very useful for shrinking the often large and painful spleens in patients with myelofibrosis, and it can often very effectively reduce the symptoms related to myelofibrosis, such as fatigue or night sweats or itching, or again, the weight loss or early fullness that one experiences with a large spleen. Now, in addition to those benefits, there are some potential side effects that one needs to take into consideration with ruxolitinib or, frankly, other JAK inhibitors that are being evaluated in the context of clinical trials. One of them is the fact that there can be a potential impact on the immune system, such that the immune system in some individuals may be suppressed, and that could place such individuals at a higher risk of infections. And this has been reported in the literature. The potential increase of infections is not necessarily only related to the use of ruxolitinib, but one needs to realize that the underlying disease, myelofibrosis, may also place the patient at risk for a higher chance of getting infections because, for example, their white blood cells may not work, so they may be not working well, or they may be low in number. And so the risk of infection is probably in part from drug, but also part from the underlying disease. So now getting back to your question, if you're having a surgery to clear out an infection, well, there are a lot of unknown variables in this particular case, and what I would just say is that it's incumbent upon the healthcare team, that is the physician who's prescribing the Jakafi, the surgeon who is performing the surgery, to get together and make a recommendation about whether to stop the Jakafi. And what I would say is that if the white blood cell count is particularly low and it's felt that the Jakafi is contributing to that lower white blood cell count, or the patient has a history of recurrent infections, these are certainly some factors that may play into the decision to stop Jakafi in this case. And so I don't necessarily think it's very appropriate for me to say for a particular case whether Jakafi should be stopped, but I certainly think that it is an option, and it's an option that should be vetted or discussed by the physicians taking care of the patient. But just to reiterate, there are increased risk of infections due to underlying disease, possibly related to drug, and the risk of infection needs to be part of the whole calculus in terms of what is the pending surgery or intervention.
Excellent. Thank you very much, and thanks. That's very helpful. Excellent question. Excellent answer to the question. We have another question from an online participant. My family has a vacation coming up. Should I tell my healthcare team? How should I prepare? Dr. Gowan, could you address that question?
Well, I think it's certainly very important to communicate with your entire healthcare team whenever you go on vacation. There certainly are preventative things depending on where you're going, if you're going out of the country, maybe you need certain vaccinations, what kind of activities are you going to be doing, and perhaps there will be recommendations regarding that. And then just some general kind of safety recommendations that apply not only to patients with myeloproliferative neoplasms, but to all of us in general, such as sunscreen and safe travel advice. So certainly I would recommend talking with your doctor and other members of your healthcare team.
Excellent. And we have another question from one of our online participants is, when and how do I go about getting a second opinion? So Dr. Gowan, could you address that as well?
Well, I think that's really entirely up to you. If you feel that there is particularly a change in your disease or you have questions that maybe your primary doctor isn't answering, I think seeking a second opinion is always is good advice as far as giving you peace of mind and just giving another recommendation on the plate for proceeding forward with your therapy. How to go about it, I think that really depends on where you are within the country and how close you are within range of an academic institution, and I think communication with your primary oncologist, hematologist, is key.
Thank you. And we have another question from one of our online participants, Malin. The CA LR mutation wasn't discussed. How soon will this be checked routinely? Are insurance companies paying for it? Dr. Gottlieb, are you familiar with this, or could you comment?
I am. Just to provide some context of this question, so CalR stands for calreticulin, and so let me just briefly talk about the mutational landscape of patients with myeloproliferative neoplasms. We know that about 95% of patients with polycythemia vera will have this JAK2 mutation, the common one that you always hear about. And then amongst patients with essential thrombocythemia, or ET, and also patients with primary myelofibrosis, the JAK2 mutation is in about 50 to 60% of patients with ET or myelofibrosis. So you can see that almost all patients with PV, their mutations are accounted for by the JAK2 mutation, but only 50 to 60% of patients with ET or myelofibrosis have the JAK2 mutation, meaning that approximately 40 to 50% of patients with ET myelofibrosis don't have the JAK2 mutation. And there's always been a question out there, well, what is the mutation occurring in those 40 to 50% of patients with ET or myelofibrosis that don't have the JAK2 mutation? Well, it was only discovered and published in the latter part of the year 2013, just a little bit more than 6 months ago, that in those patients with ET and myelofibrosis that don't have the JAK2 mutation, that the overwhelming majority of those patients have a mutation in a gene called calreticulin. And secondly, the calreticulin mutation is mutually exclusive of JAK2, meaning that if you are a patient with ET or myelofibrosis and have the JAK2 mutation, then you will essentially not have the calreticulin mutation, and vice versa. If you have the calreticulin mutation, you will not have the JAK2 mutation. Since the calreticulin mutation was published, and this is a mutation that can simply be obtained by a blood draw. You don't need to do a bone marrow biopsy to evaluate for the whether you have it. There have been various studies that have looked at basically what are the clinical relationship or outcomes if you have a calreticulin mutation versus a JAK2 mutation in the context of ET or myelofibrosis. And what I can say about that is the following. If you have ET and you have the calreticulin mutation, on average, the platelet count in patients who have ET and have the calreticulin mutation tends to be higher than that if you have the JAK2 mutation and you have ET. Conversely, if you have ET and have the JAK2 mutation, on average, the white blood cell counts and hemoglobins, that is the red blood cell counts of those patients, tend to be higher. Again, if you have the JAK2 mutation versus the calreticulin mutation. These are just, you know, relationships that you see clinically between laboratory features and having the mutation. And then finally, if a patient has a diagnosis of myelofibrosis, what does it mean to have the JAK2 mutation versus the calreticulin mutation? It appears right now, preliminarily, that the calreticulin mutation is associated with perhaps longer survival in ET versus that JAK2 mutation. But these are looking at large numbers of patients, and one can't make any specific comments about survival in any particular patient if one has JAK2 versus calreticulin mutation. These are observations that are made in large numbers of patients. And then finally, if one has, going back to ET, if you have the JAK2 mutation, that seems to be associated with a higher frequency of blood clots than the calreticulin mutation. Again, these are observations made in large numbers of patients. So this is a mutation test. It can be obtained from the peripheral blood, and doctors can make general observations about the laboratory features or clinical outcomes if you have one mutation versus the other.
Excellent. Thank you very much. That's very informative, and that sheds a lot of light on that, so thank you very much. Another question, what tips can you give regarding building a support network for our online participants? Sarah, could you address that question, please, Ms. Kelly?
Absolutely. So, you know, in terms of your support network, you want to see who is around you and who can really be there for you. You know, you may find with a diagnosis that some of those dynamics change. Often people find that certainly there are people in their lives who are there, they show up 150%, and then other people tend to shy away. So you want to find out who's there, who can be there for you. And then in terms of building that support network a little more, you want to get connected. And that could be through your treatment center. Often treatment centers have supports for patients, whether it's through classes, support groups. You want to make sure that you are also connecting with other patients. And I recommend that. Some people feel that they want to do that in groups, whether it's online, phone, or face-to-face. For some people, individual counseling is more helpful. But I do find that it's helpful to connect with others, even if it's through a peer match, because you're really talking with someone who gets it because they're going through it too. So just a couple of resources for that. You know, again, cancer care, we're here, you know, to be there with you as you go through it, and we provide the services I explained before. I also recommend getting in touch with the MPN Research Foundation, the MPN Education Foundation. I imagine that those numbers are in your packets. But those are organizations that I believe provide online support. You know, there is support out there, so it's just reaching out to find it. A good place to start is either through us at Cancer Care, through your treatment center, and then also reaching out to these MPN-specific organizations. And also, I do want to mention the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, because they provide those supports too, as well as peer matching. And I realize I mentioned that a moment ago and didn't really explain what that was. For people who don't know, peer matching programs basically will match you up with someone who is also diagnosed with your same type of cancer, and maybe you're in similar life situations. So it's another person to talk to one-on-one if you find the group situation to be overwhelming or really doesn't meet your needs. A peer match is a great option. So those are just some starting places to build your support.
Excellent. Thank you. And those resources are all in your materials that you receive from Cancer Care, and they're wonderful resources for you to consider and as well in building a network. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been an extraordinary group of speakers. I thank you so much. I want to thank all of you who've asked such wonderful questions online and all of you who've been listening as well. I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour workshop and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And so I just want to, again, reiterate all the services that you can access from Cancer Care, and I want you to take advantage of those services. We have a large number of oncology social workers here, much like Ms. Kelly, who are here to help you and provide help to you around some of your concerns. We provide practical and financial assistance. We provide counseling services, support groups on the telephone and online, and we also have many of these workshops, and, of course, many publications and fact sheets, and, of course, our website as well. Most importantly, as we conclude today, I don't want anyone on this call to feel that you're alone in coping with MPN, in coping with cancer. I want you to know that you're part of this community of support at Cancer Care, and we're here to help you. We're simply a telephone call away at 1-800-813-HOPE, or you can visit our website. But most importantly, feel that you can connect with us or with any of the other organizations and get the support that you need. We are all here to be of help to you. I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone, have a wonderful day.